All right, we're starting here from the bottom of Lamed Vav and Bet, three lines from the bottom. Tana Banan, Yadcha, Zo Smol. When it comes to putting on the tefillin, where we have the instruction to put it on your Yadcha, that Yadcha refers to your left arm. Ataomer Smol, Oeinu Ela Yamin. You say that it means the left, maybe it means the right. Tamad Omar, so now the Gemara is going to bring a series of psukim which indicate that the word Yad, it means Smol. Because it says, Af Yadi Yasda Eretz, Vimini Tipcha Shamayim. So Hashem in describing the creation of the world, he says that my hand created the foundations of the land, and my right hand put laid out or stretched out the heavens. So if you contrast Yadi with Vimini, then Yadi is going to mean left, because Yimini means right. Also over here, by the case of Yael and Sisra, it says, Yada Liated Tishlachna, Vimina Vahamut Amelim. In Shirat Devorah, where Devorah is describing what Yael did to Sisra, she says, Yada Liated Tishlachna, she stretched out her hand to grab the tent peg, Vimina Vahamut Amelim, and then her right hand, she used to wipe out or destroy those that were exhausted, referring to Sisra. But again, here you have a contrast between Yada and Yemina. And then Vomer, Lama Tashiv Yadcha, V'yeminecha Mikerev Chekecha Kale. So again, another pasuk in Tehillim, which says, why should you recoil or pull back your hand, V'yemincha, and then your right, Mikerev Chekecha Kale. From within your bosom, you should take out or end from being there, meaning that you're withholding your retribution, withholding that which you could do. But again, it contrasts Yadcha, V'yemincha. So you could understand or see why there might be a deficit in some of the psukim here. Clearly for the first two, you could see it in a poetic form, which is that they're using a different word for the same thing, especially like Vishirat Devorah, Yada Yaded Tishlachta Vimina Lamut Amelim. You could see that Yada and Yemina actually might be synonymous rather than contrasting. And that's likely why the Gemara is bringing numerous psukim to try to indicate that they think it's not just poetic in nature, but that there is a contrast over here, especially the pasuk in Tehillim seems to be the most compelling, that there is Yadcha and Yemincha right next to each other. There it seems to be that Yadcha is much more contrasted rather than synonymous with Yemincha. The Baal Tosafot just asked in general, when we spoke earlier in Zvachim with regards to Yad, we assumed that anytime it says Yad, it means Yamin. And that's with regards to the Avod of the Kuhuna. The Chachamim believe that it says Yad or Kuhuna, it means right. So why all of a sudden over here do you have a different view? All of a sudden Yadcha over here means left instead of right. He says, that maybe that there is no comparison, because tefillin are not worn on your hand. That yad in other places really means kapayat, means the palm of your hand, means your hand. And over here, even though yadcha should mean that, Chazal are going to take it out of that context and say it means something else. And so he says, even though the word yad is used, maybe it's not Yad, like the traditional Yad that we find in other places. And that's why Chazal go off in a different direction with Yad over here, rather than just assuming that whenever you speak about any body part, by definition, it's the right, unless indicated otherwise. Rabbi Yossi Achorim Omer, Matzinu Yamin Shnikra Yad. He says, wait a minute, we also have that the right is called Yad as well. Shnemar, Vaya Yosef Yashit Aviv Yad Yemino. When he saw that his father had switched his hand and put the right hand on the head of Ephraim, and the left hand on the head of Menasheh. So Yosef Yashit Aviv Yad Yemino. You see, Yad is called right in this case. Beidach, and the response to Rabbi Yosef Yachorim is, Yad Yemino Yikre, Yad Stama Lo Yikre. That's a word that is modified. It's a noun phrase of Yad Yemino. But that doesn't mean Yad means Yemino, because by the fact that it has to tell you Yemino, it shows you that Yad without Yemino would mean left. And that's why it had to specify Yemino in that case. Now, Rabbi Yosef Achoreim, in terms of what Achoreim means, Rashi, interesting enough, says, Chotmo Mishuka, that he had a pressed nose, or a depressed nose, and there was a facial feature that was, gave him this nickname, which, in a sense, is not so unusual, because we have no surnames, and you have many people with the same personal name, then how do you differentiate them? So many people were differentiated by some sort of physical feature on their body. We have that by Rabbi Yehuda Shinano. So there, Rashi in different places in Shas brings different reasons for that. So some say Rabbi Yehuda, and then they say Shinano means sharp one, which was an accolade that was given to him by Shmuel. On the other hand, sometimes Rashi says Rabbi Yehuda Shinano was that he had long teeth. or that he had very prominent teeth. And so again, you see this type of facial feature. Tosafot is not comfortable with that because we know one of the three things that don't entitle a person to Olam Haba is if you call them person by kinuyah, that you call them by their nickname or you call them by some term that is somewhat derogatory. And that's what he says over here. Hatema. How could you say kineu b'lashon ganai? How could they call him or nickname him something that was a denigration or something that was undignified by calling him a flat nose or something like that? It doesn't seem to be the right way to conduct, right way to address an individual like Rabbi Yossi. Therefore, he says that it's Al-Shem Mikomo. It was the place that he was from. And he brings other evidence to that fact that you have places that have that name. And you can see that in the Shittu Mikubetzit as well, that he brings other places in Tanakh where the word cherem or cheres is used to be a name. And therefore, he references things that it references a location and not a particular feature of Rabbi Yossi. Or some say the nickname came because he's the Bala Memra in Bechorot that deals with this Mom of Choreim. Therefore, it wasn't about him, but about the fact that he was associated with that Memra in Bechorot. Rabbi Nathan Omer, Eino Tzarich, Hari Omer, the Pasuk juxtaposes Ukshartam, Uchtavtam, so that there's Kshira and Ktiva. The Ktiva by the Mezuzah, the Kshira by the Tfilin. Mak Ktiva B'Yamin, just like when you write with your right hand, also have Kshira B'Yamin. So too, when you tie or you bind it, it's got to be done with your right hand. Came into kshira b'yamin hanacha b'smoho. By definition, if you're tying with your right hand, it's got to be on your left arm because you're not going to be tying with your right hand on your right arm. It's just not going to work, and therefore that tells you it must be on your left side. Rabbi Yossi Achoreim hanacha b'smoho minalei. So now Rabbi Yossi Achoreim, who spoke up in the Braita, all he did was say that yad doesn't teach you yamin. But he never gave you a source for the fact that Yad means small, or how do you know that Yad means small? Anacha b'smol minalei. Where does he know that from? Naflei me'echad, naflei Rabbi Natan. He'll learn it from where Rabbi Natan learns it, because Rabbi Natan doesn't require the word Yadcha to teach you that. He does it from the juxtaposition of Kshira and Ektiva. Now Rabbi Ashi, who's an Amora, interestingly enough, so it's interesting, Gemara brought just three Tanaim now, and all of a sudden Rabbi Ashi jumps in, and Rabbi Ashi brings a limud that is different than those of the Tanaim, which is interesting. The question of whether Rav Ashi is just explaining what was said before, or is he really adding a new drasha? In general, we look at this as being a new drasha. Rashi Amar miyadcha, ketiv behei. So the one time yadcha is written, not yadcha with yud dalet chav sofit, but rather yadcha is written yud dalet chav hei. And that's yadcha. And he says that is teha. That means the weak one. Now Rashi brings two ways to interpret that. Either yadcha is a female formulation of the word yad, and just like the female is considered to be the weaker one, so too yadcha would be the weaker arm, or yadcha is a play on that. It's yad keha. He sees that as a contraction of the words yad keha. So you'd have to either read it in this way, amar mi yadcha tib behei, and then it would mean yad keha. That would be the meaning of yadcha is yad keha. Or you'd have to read it in the following, yadcha tib behei. And the definition of that is keha. Not that's the word, but that's the definition because it's lashon nekeva. And that means that you're weak hand. Because Rav Ashi is a Amora, so that's why there are those that say, so Rav Ashi is just explicating on that drusha that we already had from the Tanaim. So again, you could either view Rav Ashi as so you have two positions in the Braita, and then your Rav Ashi could be a third position. Or is he just bringing an initial explanation for Rabbi Yossi Achoreim because we don't have his source, and Rav Ashi is just providing a source for him. Or it might also be a reference back to the Tana Kama, explaining why the Tana Kama thinks that Yadcha means left. He's just giving more depth to that explanation. So Amar Leih Rabbi Abba, the Rabbi Ashi, Ve'im Yadcha, Shibikoach. So now, you could look at this in one of two ways. Either sometimes a hey and a chet are exchanged, and therefore Yadcha over here would be as if it's written with a chet, and therefore he's saying, just like you say Yad Keha, you could say Yad Koach, that the stronger arm is meant over here. Or you could say that the standard default, this is what we have by the Kihuna, is that anytime you use a standard body part, like Yadcha, it usually means the stronger one or the Miyuman Shiba, the more dexterous of the two. So I'm relating, Miktiv B'chet. It's not written with a Chet. It's nice that you think that, but it's written with a Hey, not a Chet. Kitanahei. This is like a Makloket Tanaim that we have. Yadcha Behei, Zusmo, which seems to indicate that that's Rav Ashi's opinion. And therefore, that's why it's possible that Rav Ashi is in an alternate opinion over here. You see in the Braita, now we're bringing a Braita that seems to indicate there is another position, that Yadcha means Yad Kehar Yad Simo. Achirim Amim, Yadcha, the Rabotet Agidim. That Yadcha, and you can see here the change in the Girsa, that is, again, subject to a machloket, whether they're darshaning Yadcha with the hay, which is similar to the Tanakama, or is this a completely different drasha, which is Yadcha, is the Rabotet Agidim, to include a Gidim. Now, Gidim is someone who's missing a part of their arm. The question is, what part of their arm are they missing? And that really comes up in the next braita, which is Tanya Idach. We have another braita. In lo zroa, potur min tefillin. If he doesn't have a zroa, then he doesn't put on tefillin. Achayim amim, yadcha l'rabotet agidim. Yadcha comes to include a gidim. So this is going to become important. We're going to spend more time on this. But just for right now, the arm, or your hand through the top of your shoulder, is comprised of different parts. There's the yad, which is from the wrist until the tip of the fingers. There's what's called the kaneh. The kaneh is from the elbow to the wrist, the forearm. And then there is the zroa, which is from the elbow until the shoulder. So now, if you just read the pashtut of this braita, emo zroa, if he doesn't have an arm, that means already it's severed at the shoulder, then he doesn't put on tefillin, because he has nowhere to put the tefillin. Now then, achirim omrim, yadchal rabotet agidim, to include the gidim. What do you mean? How can you include a gidim? He doesn't have an arm at all. That would mean that he puts it on the opposite arm. The arm that he does have, he puts it on. That's one way to look at this. The other way to look at this is that there's a difference between gidim and ein lo zroa. Gidim would mean that he's missing his forearm. Ein lo zroa means that he's missing his entire arm. And in that way, you could explain the two braitot, that when it says that he is a gidim, you put on tefillin because his arm was severed from the elbow down. So he still has an upper arm on which to put the tefillin, and that's why you would put tefillin there. On the other hand, in lo zroa, he doesn't have an arm at all, then there's nowhere to put the tefillin, and in that way, there'd be no machloket between the different shitot over here, and that's what the Balei Tosafot say. Mara marchada, velo plige. They don't argue over here. So how to read Tosafot, it's not clear. Lo plige can mean that they drush of yadcha, can be both ways, and that means lo plige, they don't argue, both drushot are true. Or lo plige can be what I just explained, that the braitot, or the position in the braitot, don't argue, because ein lo zroa is different than gidim. They're two different scenarios. Or, you could have a machloket here, which is ein lo zroa means the same thing as gidim, and both of them mean that the forearm is missing. And it's a machloket here. When you're missing your forearm, are you able to put on tefillin? According to the Tanakhama, no, because even though yadcha means on the upper part of your arm, nevertheless, the true meaning of yadcha means your hand. And so you have to have an arm that is shalem, that reaches down to a hand in order to put on tefillin. And the acherim omrim say that as long as you have the location where the tefillin needs to be placed, that is sufficient. That leads us now into the next section, which is Tanabanan. Iter. So in the Tanakh, as well as in the Gemara, a lefty is known as an iter yad. The reason being is that because nobody would use their left hand unless there was some deficiency in their right hand. But we know today as being people that are lefties and that nobody worries about people being lefties. Two generations ago, if someone was born a lefty, they used to force them to switch their hands over to the right side because it was considered to be something that was both negative, as if the person had some physical deformity or defectiveness, that the person was using their left hand. They used to force them over to the right hand. My father always likes to point out that the words in Latin for right and left are indications of that. The word in Latin for right hand is dexter, and for a left hand is sinistar. The word sinister is on the left side, so that's a very negative association with the left side, and dexter, which means something that is functional and works well, dexterous, means that they have the capacity to do things and function properly, and so that you see this difference already, even the naming of right and left in that way. And similarly, in Chazal, you have that the right represents the Midat Tarachamim, and the left represents Midat Adin, which is also very similar to what we just said with the terms of the Latin structure of the arms. And therefore, Iter Yad is the description of someone who is a lefty, because there's something wrong with their right hand, and that's why they're using their left hand. Of course, today, there are many lefties, nothing to do with the dysfunction of their right hand, but the fact that people, or at least 20-25% of the population, is born left-handed, and therefore they are using their left hand, nothing to do with deficit in their right hand, but because their brains function in that way. So now the Gemara explains, Iter, Meniach tefillin b'mino. Someone who's a lefty puts the tefillin on his right arm. Shehu smolo. Because that is his left hand. And so that's the way, interesting enough, but probably similar to what we're saying here, is that Chazal deemed the lefty, not that he has a left hand, but his left hand is his right hand. And then his right hand is his left hand. That's how the way they formulated it, to say that basically his right and left were switched, and therefore his left hand is his right hand. And that's how they describe it. And therefore he's going to put tefillin on the other side. Gemara says, Vatanya meniach bismolo. Don't we have a braita that he puts it on his left hand? Shu smolo shel kol adam, the left of all people. Amar Abaye, Kitanya Ahi, that braita is speaking a case, Sholeit b'shtei yadav, is where he is ambidextrous. Since he's ambidextrous, then you have an option to put it on either side, then you opt with the majority. The majority of people are righties, and therefore we're going to go with the majority, and if you can do it on both hands are equally functional, then he's going to put on like a righty because the majority of people are righties. So now this has a number of implications. Bali and Tosafot already start to deal with the issue of lefty because we have two drashot over here that determine which arm you put it on. One drashot is ukshartam uchtavtam, which is just like the tiva is with your right hand. So too, the kshira has to be done with your right hand, which means it ends up on your left arm. The other drashot was yatcha, your weaker arm, is where the tefillin go. So now, Bali Tosfot would say, what happens when you have a conflict between these two issues? There are sometimes, Adam Kotev B'Yamino, person writes with his right hand, B'Sharov Masab B'Smalo, but he's able to function with his left hand. His left hand does most of the stuff, but he's writing with his opposite hand. Yesh Lehistapek, B'Ezim Ahen Meniach Tefillin. I don't know which one he should put his tefillin on. Shema Yesh Ledmoto, K'Sholei B'Shtei Yadav. Maybe he should be like an ambidextrous individual, and therefore, he would have to put on his left hand. So Tosafot doesn't know what to do with this. You have two possibilities. Is the governing principle here tiva? And therefore, if he writes with his right hand, he's a righty. Is the governing principle the weaker arm? And since he does majority of his stuff with his left hand, his right is his weaker arm. Or do we say that since he functions with both hands, happens to be that there are different items that function with both hands, therefore, he's considered to be ambidextrous. If that's the case, you put on his left arm because the majority are righties. So there you have three different views within the Bali HaTosafot. Turns out the halacha that it's a machloket aposkim. The Ramah paskins that you go after Yad Tiba. That's the governing principle. Whichever hand you write with governs the situation. The Grah paskins that Yad Ka, Yad Keha. That it should be your weak arm that governs. So now the Mishnah Berurah and then the Bar Halacha spends much more time on this, which is that you have to really look at this not just simply is it writing and weakness, but it has to do with functionality. What does the individual do with each arm? So that if a person simply writes with the opposite hand, he writes with his left hand and does everything else with his right hand, then it's according to the Ramah, he is a lefty because he writes with his left hand. But the Mishnah Berurah seems to indicate that's where the suffix lives. But if he does other things with the left hand, and to be honest with you, I'm speaking from a left-handed person's perspective, so I'm always speaking about the left. But the truth is that the Mishnah Berurah is speaking from the other perspective. He says the person who writes with their right hand and does other things with their left, do they do more than just write with their right hand? Or in the other way around, if the lefty writes with his left hand, do they do more than simply write with their left hand? Because that already indicates that it's not just writing, but it's also that there's functionality in the left hand besides the writing. Because the oddity is if someone just writes with the hand, does everything else with their other hand. The question becomes when you already do more than just write with that hand. The Mishnah Berurah says you have to really look at how much functionality there is between the two hands. And sometimes the decision is not just between writing and strength or functionality. There's writing and a whole bunch of other things. And then he does some things with the other hand. And the reason that is important is because the majority of lefties are not pure lefties. Most lefties do some things with their right hand. And many of them do a lot of things with their right hand. If I get a pure lefty where they both write and they do everything functionally with their left hand, is actually more rare than you think because the majority of lefties do a lot of things with their right hand. Some of that happens to be just in earlier generations when you grew up, almost all the equipment, all things were built for righties. And therefore you just learned how to do things with your right hand because that's why everything was set up. Today, there's so much more that is put together that allow lefties or function for lefties as well. They are actually probably more pure lefties today than there were in the past, as well as the fact that people changed because of the forced changing between left and right. But the Bir Halacha spends a lot of time on this, and it obviously leads to a number of issues in terms of the lefty-righty situation when you have these mixed issues between strength and dexterity, which is really what the difference is. Writing and some things like that are dexterity questions. Fine motor skills versus gross motor skills and strength, which can be in the other arm, or, and that's what you're trying to balance here, which is the governing factor. And again, the machloket in the psak, and also besides the machloket in the psak, it runs the person into a problem in a number of areas. One of them is tefillin, another one is ktivat sefer Torah, and being a sofer, where the Mishnah Berurah advises against someone with that problem not writing, because they're not really defined whether they're lefty or righty. If you're pure lefty, then you write with your left. That's not a question. You're righty, you write with your right. When you have this mix, it's questionable. In other areas of halacha, it's less problematic because ktiva is not the question. I mean, that if you're taking a lulav, so a lulav is not a question of whether it's your writing hand or your stronger hand, just a question of which one is the stronger hand, and that's it. That's the basic question. By tefillin and by ktiva, like by a sofer, the ktivat stam, with the sofer, ktiva, or writing, takes a prominent role. And that's why it starts to raise the issues of the difference between dexterity and strength, and that's why these questions come up. And you can see already the Baalei Tosfot are dealing with it, which means that they're already aware of this issue, or they're already aware of people that have this issue of writing with one hand and strength in the other arm. And that their problem is mostly in the reverse. Most of the poskim speak about the reverse problem, and that's likely because of the forced change, that people who wrote with their left hand, they were forced to move over to their right hand. So in terms of writing, they were forced to the other hand. But in development, their stronger arm was their left hand, and it ended up being the stronger arm. So that's a classic case that's mentioned in the post-scheme, even though the majority of the cases today are the opposite, which is that it's someone with a lefty writing with their left hand and has a stronger right arm. But the post-scheme basically speak about the case that the Baalei Tosfot raised over here. Now, it's also important to know the issue of functionality over here, which is that even though we're learning these through drashot, in a situation or scenario where you're wearing tefillin all day, then if you were to put your tefillin on the stronger arm, that would render you incapacitated in terms of functionality for the day. Because you have tefillin on the arm, you couldn't do anything. So putting the tefillin on the weaker arm allows you then to function during the day. And that might be some of the problem here with the question of writing versus strength, which is that which arm are you going to put it on to leave the other arm functional? If the issue is ktiva, then you're going to follow that one arm that you need for ktiva is free, and the other one has the tefillin on it. If you need strength to do work, then maybe the one that is the weaker one needs to have the tefillin on, and the strong one needs to be free in order to do the work or be functional during the day. Today, where we put on tefillin just for davening, it's less of an issue, because we're not really doing anything functional while the tefillin on. But when you're wearing tefillin all day, these types of questions become very paramount, because you're going to have one arm that, in a sense, is somewhat incapacitated because you have tefillin on them, and that means the other arm is the arm that's free to do whatever you need to do. And even though hashkafically we view the placement of tefillin on the rosh as we say in the Hinei Nimuchan that you say before putting on tefillin, is that all our thoughts and all our ideas and everything that we have is governed by the tefillin, the Torah, and the word of Hashem. So too, when we bind on our arms, it means that all of our actions and all the activities we engage in are bound by Hashem. Nevertheless, to put it on the stronger arm, which would be the strongest indicator of that, would then render you unable to do anything during the day. And so then it wouldn't serve as a siman, because you couldn't do anything. That's why we opt for it to be on the weaker arm, so that you are functional, but still has that effect of reminding you of the fact that your actions are governed by Hashem. All right, now we move on to placement of tefillin. Tana de Beit Menashe, al yadcha zu kiboret. That al yadcha is not the palm of your hand, but rather kiboret, which means, according to Rashi, he brings the last word for it, which is an indication of your bicep, badron. As the Baalei Tosfot say, that badron refers to the collection or the mass that is in the upper part of the arm, and that is the bicep. Bein enecha zu kadkod. And again, then, bein enecha does not mean literally between your eyes, but rather it means kadkod, the head, the skull, hecha, where is that? Amrei de Bei Rabbi Yanai, makom shemocho shel tinok rofes. It's in the soft spot of the skull of a young child. And again, that raises, it's up here, it sits on the top of your head. If you go to the peak of your head, at the top of your head, and move forward a little bit, that's with the location that they're speaking about. Generally, you can get to there if it's parallel to your ear. Where your ear is attached to your face, If you move your hand up straight over that top, that is the top of your head, and in front of that line is where the head of the tinokas will face. Now, that doesn't mean that that's the sole location to place the tefillin, but rather it is the furthest back that you can place the tefillin. We will bound the area that you can put on tefillin. Tosafot over here spends a tremendous amount of time discussing the location of the tefillin. I'm going to postpone it for a minute because there are going to be other drashot here, and then we're going to spend time on the proper location of tefillin, both on the arm and on the head. By mine palimo mi rabbi. Palimo asks Rabbi a question. Someone has two heads, and which head do you put on tefillin? Amarle, Rabbi gave the same response that all you gave to him. Okum gali, okabal alecha shamto. So the way that Rashi reads this is either put yourself in galut or accept a nidoy. Because this is a ridiculous question. This is not a realistic question. Why are you bothering me with this question? That's one way to read it. I would have read it, okum gali. Either show me an instance like this, show me a case like this, oh, kabel alecha shamto, or you're going to be put into nidoy. If you're bringing up this question, you better have something to show for it. Meaning that, where do you get this question from? Adahachi, in that moment, atahu gabra. I'm late. Sure enough, the guy had a baby that had two heads on it. From what Rashi is describing here, it seems there was a single body, but two heads, opposed to Siamese twins, which happen to have joint bodies and share some things, but they have a number of things that are differentiated. Kama, bein in the mate of the Kohen. His question wasn't about tefillin, it's a newborn baby. His question is for Pidyon Ben. How many children is he being pulled dead here because it's a firstborn child? Person's asking with regards to the Kohen. Now, if you have twins, there's no question that you only pay the Kohen five because only one of the two children could have been pet their rechem. On the other hand, over here, since they are attached together in a single group, Rashi says it's a possibility of tzimtzum over here, that they both exited the rechem at the same time exactly, and therefore maybe you have to pay twice to the Kohen. That's his question. Atum sabo. So then some elder showed up. Obviously they hadn't had this case in the Beit Midrash for a long time. Tanolei, chayev liten yud sloim. He has to pay 10. He has to pay for two heads. He's got to pay. Ini, is that really true? Vatani rami barchama mitoch shenemar podo tifted b'chor adam. I would have thought even if he died within the first 30 days, he would still have to pay for it. Since you have to redeem all Bechor Adam. Tomalomar, ach, chilek. Ach comes to tell you that, ach padotifteh, that it's not always that you have to pay for it. So now, first of all, it's clear that if the individual died before the 30-day period, the person does not have to pay the kohen for the pigeon because he didn't make it to 30 days. And so if he doesn't make the 30 days, 30 days is the threshold by which one is chayav and pidyon ben. Rashi says over here, afilini trapatak lamed yom means that he was killed within the first 30 days of life. So he had the capacity to live 30 days, but the life was cut short or snuffed out, not because they died naturally or not because it was a trefa, but because the child was killed in that period of time. So the child would have made it past the 30 days had it not been for the fact that someone killed the child in that interim period. So that's the question. Since he could have lived to the 30 days and was killed, maybe you should have to pay for the pigeon. That's tamaloma ach, that you don't pay for the pigeon in that case. That's what it comes to teach you. It's since he didn't make it to the 30-day period. So too, someone with two heads who's not going to live, just like someone who was killed and is patur, so too, the child with two heads who's not going to survive is also going to be patur mi pigeon ben. That's what Rashi says. The Rabbeinu Tam is bothered by Rashi's explanation because he says, that's a Mishnah. It's an explicit Mishnah that if you don't make it to 30 days, you don't pay the Pidyon HaBen. He says it's very clear that even if a person prepays for Pidyon HaBen, if the money is not extant at the time you get to the 30 days, he's not yotzei the mitzvah. The 30 days is the threshold. And no matter what, it's the threshold. And he says it's a gzeira takatub that it's 30 days. Now really, the reason that Chazal learned from 30 days is that after 30 days, you know whether the child's a bar kayama or not. In that if a child is a trefa, they won't make it past the 30-day point. So the reason to wait for 30 days for Pidyon HaBen is because then the child is a viable entity. And as a viable entity, then you have to do Pidyon Bechor. So that's the reason for the 30 days. Despite that, the Rabbeinu Tam says it's a gzera dekatu. It doesn't really matter, because even if a child is born with what's called kalulu chadushab, you got the full term, and therefore we know it's not a trefa, there's nothing wrong with the child, you still have to wait for the 30 days. And what I just described, with the money's not extant the 30 days if you prepaid, you don't get the mitzvah. You have to be podeh again. So he says 30 days is a threshold irrespective of the health of the child. And therefore he says, what Rashi is saying here makes no sense. If the child was killed within 30 days, there's just no way you're going to be paying for pidyon bakor, and there's no havamina for that. So Rabbeinu Tam explains it, and first Rabbeinu Tam, the nitra afainu nase treifa. The child was a treifa, afo pi shechayi yoter milamed yom, but he makes it past the 30-day threshold. You have a treifa, but the treifa wasn't supposed to make it past 30 days. But the child did. Well, the child's living longer than 30 days, even though it's a treifa. The kevin sheyesh lo shnei roshim hainu treifa. Two roshim is a treifa because called the yeter kenotul dami. Anything that is excess is if it's taken off. So the child has this, whatever, open space or wound or whatever is there that makes it into a treifa. If it's a treifa, that's the question. Does he have to pay for pidyon ben? And the answer is, ach, that you don't have to pay for pidyon ben because a treifa is not considered to be chayo, it's not considered to be a living or viable entity. So even if it makes past the 30 days, you don't pay for it. Ach, that's the limud. Then we have a retort to that, which is shani ocha. It's not true here to be gola golet tala rachmana. That might be true, again, by neharag. That might be true, again, where you have a case where the treifa is born and lives past the 30 days, you don't have to pay. So even though, normally, if someone's going to die, they would not require pidyon ben, nevertheless, over here, because they are alive now, and they have two roshim, and therefore they're going to be chayav. There's a specific din that the redeeming of the bechor is by gugolta, is by the gugolet, which is chamesh sela le gugolet. That it's by a head count, or a head tax, we'll call it, or poll tax, which is that you're paying the kohen for every head that you have. And therefore, in this instance, even though we have the drosha, the fact that the child has two heads, you're going to pay a double tax over here. If he makes it according to Rabbeinu Tam past the 30-day threshold, even though he is a treifa, nevertheless, this treifa, zeret katuv, still has to pay for two heads, because that's the determining factor here for what you pay in terms of pidyon bechor, and that's an exceptional case. Still doesn't answer the question with regards to the tefillin, but you have to assume is that if we say this is unique to Bechor, that it has to do with the two heads, then by the case of tefillin, you wouldn't put tefillin on the two heads. You'd have to pick one of the two heads to put on. Some say that that was the question of polimo from the outset. Just like by Yadcha, you put on the left hand, so too by the heads, you put on the left head and not the right head. I mean, is there any parallel between the arm, extracting the Ota Yadcha, Lutotofo Bene Necha, or do we just say that over here, since it's determined by head, and so too by tefillin, it's Al Rosh Ka, and since the Rosh is the determining factor where you have to put it, Bene Necha, since there are two Bene Necha, you're going to have to put on two pairs of tefillin over here, so that the din would be the same as that of Bechor. Obviously, in terms of realistically, it's not clear that they're really asking the question, they're trying to figure out what's the main Mechayev of tefillin Shel Rosh, and El Pidyon Bechor, and that's what they're doing. This is an extreme case that gives you an indication of what is the determining factor. Now we go back to placement, and this is where we're going to spend time on, the proper placement of tefillin. Amar Mar, Yadcha Zoki Boret. Yadcha, that is the bicep. Minolon, how do you know that's the case? The Tan Rabbanan, Al Yadcha, Zogova Shebiyad, that's the high point of the arm. Daomer Zogova Shebiyad, that's the high point of the arm. Oeinu Ela Yadcha Mamash. Or maybe it means on the hand, on the palm of your hand. Amar Torah Anech Tefillin Biyad, Anech Tefillin Berosh. It says, put your tefillin on your hand, put your tefillin on your head. Malalan begovash berosh. Just like by the tefillin shirosh, it means at the pinnacle or the point of your head. Avkan begovash shibiyan. So to over here, it means on the pinnacle or the point of your arm. Truth is that by the rosh also, you don't go to the highest point of the rosh. The soft place is in front. The peak of your head is back here. It's in front of it. So it's just below the peak of your head. And that might be the drush also by Yadcha. It's not at the way peak of your arm, which would be at the armpit or the shoulder, but it's a little below that area. That could be the drush over here. Or it could be the bicep, because that's an area that is elevated on the arm. And that's why that's Gova Shebiyad. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Eino Tzarich. You don't need that limud. Ari Omer. By Tefillin Shebiyad, it's an oat for you and not oat for others. And therefore, it's got to be in a place or location which is not normally visible to others. If it's on your hand, that's something that everybody else sees. If it's up on your arm, that's something that's normally covered by your sleeve. And therefore, by the covering of the sleeve, or it's normally an area that's not always or easily visible, therefore it's an oat for you and not oat for others. You don't need that, Lumud. It says there that you have to put these things, meaning the Torah, on your heart. And then right afterwards it says, you tie the tefillin on your arm. That it should be next to or opposite the heart. So that would mean a placement on the arm level with the heart of the body. And again, that would be on the upper arm. And then we have the halacha that derives from this, which is, they used to put on their tefillin, they used to tilt it towards the heart in order to accomplish this juxtaposition in the Torah, samtem et ra'el alavavchem, and ukshartem, which is that there's a connection between leiv and kshira, and therefore when you put on your tefillin shayad, you tilt them slightly towards your heart. So again, for a righty, that would be right next to the heart, because it would be over there. For a lefty, he's putting on his right arm, he'd still face it towards the heart, but it's not immediately adjacent to the heart. Right, so now let's discuss placement of tefillin. It's clear that there were alternate views, because the Baalei Tosfot spent a lot of time on explaining what is the proper positioning of the tefillin, and that's because the word yad. You're dealing with a word yad, and the word yad in general means a hand. So there were people who put their tefillin on their hand. And it's clear that there were sects like that because the Mishnayot in other places come to say that people who do that are considered to be minim. There are people who are outside of the normal practices of the faith and they need to be excommunicated or put out. And we know that during the time of the end of Bayit Sheni, when you have all these wild sects running around like you see in other different sects, there were many sects that took the Torah very literally instead of the interpretation of Chazal. And they placed the tefillin al yadcha, literally on the hand, or, as Baalei Tosfot indicated over here, there was a prevalent practice to put it on the forearm. And that is because yadcha, and then they say kiboret over here. The question of translation of kiboret, kiboret means a gathering of flesh, it really means muscle. And so you have two points along the arm where you have the gathering of the muscle. You have the bicep, and then you have the forearm. And so the question is, which one of those bulges is what you put the tefillin on? So there were many of the opinion that you put it on that area, which is the forearm, where you have that muscle expanse. That's where you placed it. And that comes down to the discussion of what it means, zroa. The word zroa is used to describe over here the placement of where the tefillin belong. And where is the zroa? So there were people in Rashi and other places translate zroa to be the area that's between the wrist and the elbow. So Tosfot criticizes that explanation over there, but then says over here, even though Rashi over here does not say it here, over here Rashi makes it clear that the zroa is the area between the elbow and the shoulder. And that's what Tosfot focuses on over here, explaining and proving the fact that the zroa is really the area between the elbow, what they call the koda in their vernacular. So it's between the koda and the kateif, the shoulder and the elbow. And it says the area between the koda and the wrist, that's the kaneh. So if you look at the arm, you have a yad, which is the hand from the fingers up to the wrist. You have a kaneh, which is from the wrist until the elbow. And then you have a zroa, which is from the elbow until the shoulder. But you should also keep in mind that that might be why we have to do krichot ala yad. The krichot that we do in our hand might be the accomplishment of the pashtut of the pasuk, which are tam leota yadcha. Even though the drasha moves the boxes of the batin themselves higher up, we still have a manifestation of yadcha through the krichot on the yad. And that might be, again, why there is a requirement of yad, even though that's not where the tefillin are placed. And that might explain that view of the Tanakama, that even if you're missing the part of the arm below the elbow and you still have the area where you could put on the tefillin, that you're patur, because you're missing that accomplishment of the pashtut, which is yad. It has to connect the yad, the real meaning of yad, which means hand or palm in some way. And that's done through the krichot. And without that, you can't accomplish the kshira of the tefillin or the batim up on the zroa. The question then, where do you place it? We're assuming that Tosfot is right. That's what's accepted by most of the Rishonim as being the proper explanation. Again, even though there were deviant opinions and people who seemingly put it on their forearms, because the Tosfot is spending so much time showing you that it's wrong and showing that those interpretations are wrong, it's clear that he's facing interpretations like that. So then the placement is on the upper part of the arm. Where on the arm? Rashi over here says, but the badron, which is by the bicep. So where on the bicep do you have to place it? The way that the Rishonim describe it over here, it's subjective, so it works for every person, which is that if you start from the bend in your arm, where your elbow is, if you take two etzbaot, if you take two fingers and place them on the bend of your elbow, that is the beginning of your bicep. For every person, that will be the beginning. That's where your bicep starts to rise up on your arm. You just put the two fingers here and just bend your arm, you'll feel at the end of those two fingers, your bicep begins to rise. That is the lowest point that you can put tefillin. If you put the tefillin where those two etzba'ot are, you have not been yotzei the mitzvah of tefillin. That's an important factor we're going to see now. You're better to err being higher than lower because you're not yotze. If it's lower, if it's over that area where the two fingers are, you haven't accomplished the mitzvah of tefillin. So that's the first thing. The second thing, it's got to be on the bicep. Where along the bicep? So, according to everyone, the chatfila, it should be in the rising part of the bicep. So that the bicep rises and peaks. Where it peaks is about the halfway point of the bone that runs from the elbow to the shoulder. That bone that runs from the elbow to the shoulder, the halfway point of that bone is where the bicep peaks. So the proper placement of tefillin, and this is the way the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah Paskin, is you put the tefillin, it has to be two etzba'ot off of your bend in your arm where the elbow is. And then it's got to be in the area between the beginning of the rise of your bicep and the midpoint of your bicep or the midpoint of that bone on your arm. That is the proper location of the tefillin. According to Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, that's the only location for the tefillin. If you're below that point or above that point, you haven't been kind of the mitzvah of tefillin. So that means that people with smaller arms maybe need smaller tefillin. But it has to be an area where it's sitting in that proper location. Exactly what needs to sit there is also a good question because the tefillin, as we know before, consisting of the batim, as well as the ma'barta, where the strap is. Question of how much or what needs to exactly be in there. That's also a discussion. The Gra is of the opinion that b'diavad, you can put the tefillin all the way up to the descent of the bicep. That means that where the bicep ends. So you not only have the location where from the rise of the bicep to the midpoint of the bicep, which is the midpoint of the zroa, of the bone that runs from the elbow to the shoulder, but you also have an additional space that comes where the bicep drops to the final descent. He says you can put it anywhere on the bicep. Now the chatfila should be on the front of the bicep, the rise to the midpoint, but if you put it on the back part of the bicep, you're still yotze. Above that, which means from the beginning of the shoulder, you can feel that where your shoulder starts to rise out of your arm, at that point everybody agrees it's problematic. So too low, which means within two etzba'ot of the elbow, is pasul. Up by the shoulder, the beginning of the rise of the shoulder, also pasul. The area in between is possibly kasher. The Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, that means from the rise of the bicep to the midpoint of the bicep. The Gra means even the other side of the bicep. But that's why I was saying before, it's better to err to be higher than lower. If you're lower, nobody thinks you're yotze. If you're a little higher, the Gra still thinks that you are yotze. So that's with regards to tefillin shel yad. The second thing is, that we want you to tilt it slightly towards your heart, so that you don't center it on the arm, but tilt it a little bit. The truth is that if you put on your tefillin flat, that when you turn your arm in, by definition, the tefillin will turn with your arm towards your heart. Because if you lay your arm out flat, put the tefillin on, as soon as you recoil your arm also turns inward, and therefore the tefillin will, almost by design, be facing your heart, although we still have the practice to tilt them, even with on the bicep, tilt them a little bit inward, so that it does face the heart. So that's in terms of tefillin shel yad. Let's finish up a little bit more of the Gemara, and then we'll discuss the proper placement of the tefillin shel rosh. Gemara says, Ravashi Abiyotiv Kameda Meimar. Ravashi was sitting in front of a Meimar. Abitziria Abiyotiv. He had some sort of injury or wound on his arm. Kamechazi and tefillin. And therefore his tefillin were visible. The reason seems to be, as Rashi says over here, the beged where the wound was torn, so it wouldn't rub against the wound. And then, since he didn't have a sleeve, his tefillin were visible because his sleeve was ripped in that area. And he says to him, Amalei, lo sabalar mar, lo chala ot, lo lacherim not. Don't you hold to this drasha, that the tefillin needs to be an oat for you and not an oat for someone else. Now your tefillin are visible. Amalei, but makom lo chala ot. He says, no, that's not an absolute necessity. But rather, it is being the place where generally it will only be for you an oat, not for other people an oat. Therefore, the halacha is, and it's brought down, again, that you do not need to cover your tefillin shel yad. From the Gemara, v'ayah lo chala ot. And after Achayim Oth, it would sound like you should put your sleeve, you should put something over your tefillin shel yad, because then nobody else can see it. And that's what is being suggested over here by Ameimar. Tefillin shel yad, you would have thought, need to be covered. So the halacha, or what comes out, derives from this, it has been the location that's normally covered, but they themselves do not need to be covered. What it does exclude is placing the tefillin on top of your sleeve, which is a practice that's noted by the Gemara, the Mishnayot, and Megillah, that there were people who put tefillin above their sleeves. And those people are considered to be, again, minin. These are people who do not follow the protocols of the Chachamim, and they were placing their tefillin above their sleeves. That's clearly not allowed, because it has to be directly on the body, directly on the yad. But you do not have to go back and cover it up, although there are many people who do cover up their tefillin. Again, because of this idea of oh, but it's not necessary, as you see here from the Gemara by Ravashi and Ameimar. Itmar, gobe shemarosh minolan. How do you know you have to put it on the high point of the head? The Tanur Banan, Bein Einecha, Zu Gova Sheberosh. Bein Einecha, between your eyes, means the height of the head. The Talmud, Zu Gova Sheberosh, Bein Einecha Mamash. Maybe it should be really just between your eyes. Again, there were sects that practiced exactly that. They had tefillin right between their eyes. That's where they wore their tefillin. Nemrakan Bein Einecha, Benemran Lahalan. Lota Simu Karcha Bein Einechem Lemeit. Also over there it says, do not rip out your hair between your eyes for a mate. Now, ripping out your hair, malahalan begoba shibarosh, makom sho sekarcha, meaning that the place where you're going to rip out your hair and make yourself into a kereach, into a bald person, is on the head where there's hair. If you're not on the head where there's hair, you can't be a kereach. If that's true, but there, where it says bene nechem, then also over here, avkan begoba shibarosh, makom sho sekarcha. Similarly over here, the place where it's been a bene necha, doesn't mean literally between your eyes. It means in a location where the hair, if you ripped it out, would make you into a kereach, into a bald person. And for that reason, that's the placement of where the tefillin go. You don't even need that. Amra Torah, anach tefillin biyad, anach tefillin birosh. Just put your tefillin on your eye, put your tefillin on your rosh. Malalan mamakom haro'od litamei b'nege achad. Just like by the arm, it's a location where only one type of tzarat applies, which is nige basar, nige ora basar. So too, afkam b'makom haro'i litamei b'nega achad. So too over here, only a place where there's one type of nega that applies. Afuke b'nei necha, d'ika basar v'se'ar. Over there you have two types of negaim that can affect you, because there's a nega which affects the rosh and the zakan, which is areas that have hair. So those areas are subject to a different din of tzarat. And then there's ora basar, that has to do with skin or flesh, that's tzarat on a flesh. So b'nei necha, you have your eyebrows, and you have the skin there. If you put on tefillin b'nei necha, they're going to be sitting on a location that involves two possible negaim. And the simanim are different. The simanim for rosh and zakan, it's se'ar tzahov. It's yellowish hair. That's mitameh in those cases. Whereas ora basar, it's white hair that makes it tameh. So they have different dinim, tzarat of different types. And he said, just like on the yad, there's only one type of tzarat there in that location, which is tzarat ora basar. So to here, you have to only put in a place where there's only one type of tzarat. But it not Bene Necha, where there's Zika Seir Lavan, Zika Nema Seir Tzahov. But you have some Tumah that comes from Seir Lavan, some Tumah that comes from Seir Tzahov. The truth is, you could argue that you don't have to put on your head, you could just put on your forehead. That would have been a sufficient enough argument. Tosafot already raises that issue. Says, Zim Tamar, Malalam B'Makom Basar. Just like on the arm, it's in a place where there is Basar. Af Kad B'Makom Basar. That would be your forehead. Then you avoid the problem. It's a single type of Nega, because that's only Ora Basar here, and you would be actually equivalent or more equivalent to what you're doing by the Yad, which is also by Ora Basar. Now the truth is, it's not so clear, because there may not be enough space in the forehead to get the tefillin in without touching the hair of your head, the hairline of your head or your eyebrows, so then you have to be a small enough tefillin in order to fit in there, but that's possible. That's what those of us suggest over here, but in the end, the Chazal darshan about Govash and Barosh. It's got to be on the high point of the Rosh. And that might have to do with what we spoke about before, which is that Veruam Eretz, right? They will see your tefillin, Veruam Mimecha. So it's got to be in a placement which is visible, or a placement which is high up, because that's something that we want to be as visible as possible. And that might be a contributing factor here as well, is that you want to get as far back as possible. From this, it turns out that the area where one puts on tefillin actually runs a span of space, which is mentioned in the Gemara in Eruvin. You have the possibility of putting on two tefillin of Shorosh in the location where it's allowed to be put on. So that could be two possibilities. One possibility is it could be side by side. There might be enough room to put on tefillin to run next to each other. Now, I heard this in the name of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, that he made a suggestion, not the halacha, but he says that maybe the interpretation of Bene Necha means between your eyes. We always think of Bene Necha to mean the nose, where the nose sits between the eyes. That's between the eyes. He says maybe between the eyes means like this. From your left edge of your eye to the right edge of your eye. And Bene Necha means as long as it's between where your eyes sit, you have this whole area. That actually would give you two locations to put tefillin on top, side by side, because they're both Bene Necha. They're not literally between your eyes, but they're within the parameters of your eyes. In the furthest right of your eye and the left of your eye, anything that's in between is good. So that might give you a possibility of side by side. And again, the Rishonim, when they said, Maran Irvin says two places for possibility of two tefillin, they discuss. Some say side by side, some say back and forth. The majority opinion, or the majority view, is back and forth. And that is because the two locations that were given here, one was it has to be makom, where there's only one nega, which means makom ha-se'ar, it's where the hair of the head is. That means that the placement of the tefillin can start from where your hairline starts. So that's the most forward part of the tefillin, is where your hairline starts. It doesn't mean your current hairline, it means where your hairline once was. So that is the starting point of where you can put tefillin. The second thing is that the furthest back you can go is makom shemocho, the place where your skull or the brain, where it's soft in the tinok. That's just below. Again, the peak of the head is just in front of that area. You have a soft spot in the skull today. It's less soft, but it was when you were a baby, much softer over there. And again, I told you before that the easy way to test for that is if where your ear is attached to your face, the front. You just run a line straight up, that will be the peak point, the furthest back it can be. That means the entirety of the box must sit between the hairline in the front and the line in the back, which is that peak point in the back where the soft part of the skull is. Again, if you use your finger, go over where your ears are, that'll be the furthest back it can be, and the hairline will be the furthest forward it can be. That means the entirety of the box must sit between those two points. That's, most people have the failure in the front, which is that many people wear their tefillin and it hangs over the front, and it's too far to the front. Their hairline was never that low. Even when they were younger, it was never that low, and therefore it's too far front, and you're not yoked in the mitzvah of tefillin. You have more space going backwards. Again, if you can put on two pairs of tefillin, you have enough space to go back and put a second pair of tefillin. So you're always better off erring on putting the tefillin higher up than lower down, because you have a lot of room going backwards versus forward. Cook wrote a whole book called Chavush Pe'er, where he speaks about this issue, that he walks around all the time, and everybody's wearing their tefillin in the wrong place, and tefillin shorosh, and it's something that we need to speak about, and we have to educate people that they're not being yoked to the mitzvah of tefillin shorosh, because they have it too far forward, and nobody's wearing their tefillin properly. And again, I say till today, that many people wear their fair tefillin too far forward. Again, you have room for two pairs of tefillin. Just move it back. It's so much safer to move the tefillin back. Again, we discussed 2 days ago, Zap, about the kesher till tefillin and the proper placement of the kesher tefillin. Again, at the base of the skull and that V that you have in the back of your neck where the skull ends, that area there, that's where the kesher should sit. Some people have it to be very high up. The neck V in the skull rise very high, and it's hard for them to do that. So that's not a ma'akev. The part of the box is where they sit. That is ma'akev. And you need to place it there. Again, the keshel tefillin, we spoke about on Friday's daf, about the location of being mupanim and mo'oref and that location. So it's got to be up on the head. Some people have such a V in the back that it's so high up that even if they put it lower, it's okay. But generally, just for location, if you feel your back, you pull your neck up, you'll feel that there's a gap in there, and you come up to the skull, the base of the skull, that's where you want the kesher to sit, is on that base of the skull. Well, that's far as placement of tefillin. All right, now we leave the world of tefillin, and we move over to the last part of the previous Mishnah, which is also the introduction to the next parak. We're going to spend a lot of time on tzitzit and tehillet, and we saw at the end of the previous Mishnah, this is what got us into all this, which was whether the arba tzitziot are me'akev. Where the four tzitzit mekayev each other, which is the view of the Tanakhama, the Chachamim, and is the view of Rabbi Shmuel, who says that they are not mekayev each other. And the Gemara asks over here, my benayu, what's the difference between them? What's the nafkamina halacha? The truth is that the nafkamina halacha is so obvious that some say that can't be the question of the Gemara over here. Rashi seems to note that even according to Rabbi Ishmael, there is a necessity to have four tzitzit. And therefore, that's the Gemara's question over here. My benayu, if the tzitzit are mekayev each other according to both views, and one says it's four mitzvot, and one says it's one mitzvah, my benayu, what's the difference between them? If you say, and Rashi seems to indicate this way, that even though you're supposed to put on four, according to Rabbi Shmuel, but they're not ma'akev each other, and each one's an independent mitzvah, then my benayu means, what's the difference between having to put on all four tzitzit, maybe we put on less than four tzitzit, and that'll become obvious, the nafkamina that are going to be brought by the Amoraim, and some say that that's it. It was a setup question. The question's not a real question. They just want the nafkamino. They want all the halachot that the Amoraim are going to bring. So they just put in my benayu to get to that. It's just a stepping stone to get to the next section of the Gemara. Shazam Rav Yosef Sadim Tzitzit Ike Benayu. The difference between them is putting tzitzit on a linen beged. We know that when it comes to tzitzit, that tzitzit override the issue of shatnez. That's because of the adjacency, juxtaposition of gedilim fasedacha and lo tubash beged shatnez. Shatnez and tzitzit in Sefer Dvarim are adjacent to each other. And from that we learn that tzitzit are allowed to be made with shatnez. When you wear a linen beged, by definition you have to use shatnez. And that's because tehillet has to be on wool. That's the definition of tehillet. Tehillet is wool dyed with the color of tehillet. And that we know from the Big Day Kuhuna. We know it from any time tehillet is mentioned, it's always associated with wool. So even though if you have a woolen baguette, you don't have to have tzitzit that are made out of linen for the white tzitzit. The white tzitzit could be made out of wool. That means if you're wearing a woolen baguette, you do not have to have shatnezin in order to be able to do the mitzvah. You may be allowed to, but you don't have to. When it comes to linen baguette, you have to have shatnez in it in order to be yotzei. So now you put in the tzitzit. So if you put the tzitzit in, Amar Yosef, sadim tzitzit ekim enayu. Because if you now have four tzitzit on there, and you're accomplishing the mitzvah of tzitzit, then in accomplishing the mitzvah of tzitzit, you override the isur of shatnez. So according to the Tanakhama, that's only if you have all four tzitzit in the tzitzit, because then you're doing the mitzvah. According to Rabbi Yishmael, believes that each one is an independent mitzvah, then each one by itself, even if you're missing one of the tzitzit, the other three tzitzit are not a violation of shatnez, because each one independently is a mitzvah. Now again, that could be formulated in two ways. One is that each one's a mitzvah, and they're not makdev each other, and therefore, even if you don't have four, you're doing a mitzvah with one, two, three, and therefore you're accomplishing the mitzvah, and therefore there's no shatnez. Or it could be that each one in itself is a mitzvah, they are makdev each other. In the end, to have proper tzitzit, you need all four to be there. But nevertheless, since each one is an independent mitzvah, while it's on the beggar, you're not going to be chayav and shatnez because it's in the process of accomplishing the mitzvah. And since each one is independent, it's enough independence to say that you're not chayav for kilayim in that situation. Rabba barahine amar, talit balat chamesh igabinayu. A five-cornered beged is the nafkamina between them. The way Rashi reads this is, if you have five corners, the Tanakhama says there's mitzvah four. Four is the mitzvah, not five. And so therefore you put on four corners of the five. Rabbi Yishmael says that each one is a separate mitzvah. Every corner is a separate mitzvah. And then you're going to put five tzitzit on a beged with five corners. And that's machloka between them. When you have a beged of five knafot, do you put on four tzitzit, the four corners, or do you put it on the five corners? And that's the machloka between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yishmael. The Karen Orah already brings, it's found in some of the Rishonim as well, that he thinks that that's not the nafkamina, that the nafkamina is whether you put on tzitzit at all. According to the Tanakhama, the mitzvah is four corners. If you don't have four corners, you don't have a mitzvah. Palat Chamesh is exempt. It's going to be patur from tzitzit legamrei. Which Shmuel says that each corner is an independent mitzvah. So then, and even on a five-cornered beggar, there you're going to put it on. So he sees that as being the nafkamina, according to this Palat Chamesh. Ravina Amar, the Ravuna Yigabeinayo. The loch of Ravuna is the nafkamina over here. Dam Ravuna Yotzei B'talit She'enemitz Yuetzet Keyo Chatah B'Shabbat Chayav Chatah. Person who walks out with a talit that doesn't have tzitzit on it properly, it's chayav chatat for carrying on Shabbat. Tzitzit are not a natural part of the beged. They are something that's added onto the beged. If you are accomplishing the mitzvah of tzitzit, then they become a part of the beged because they are now considered to be an adornment or they're considered to be a part and parcel of the beged. So if you're accomplishing the mitzvah of tzitzit, then you don't have a problem of carrying. Then if you're not accomplishing the mitzvah of tzitzit, then you're carrying because those are just excess strings hanging off the beged. For the Tanakhama who says you need all four to be yotzei the mitzvah, if you only have three tzitzit, say one of the tzitzit ripped off, then the other three are not accomplishing anything. They are a burden. They're something that's an excess on the beged. There's no necessity for them on the beged. Therefore, it's considered like carrying when you go out on Shabbat into the Rishut Rabim. The other hand, for Rabbi Shmuel, says that each one of them is a mitzvah, then you're still accomplishing the mitzvah, and they're not considered to be carrying because they are necessary or they are proper to be on the beged. Therefore, it's not a problem of carrying on Shabbat. Now, this also has implications for what is also known as the Brisker Chumrah. Brisker Chumrah is that if you don't wear tzitzit that are chayav mi doraita, that if you go out into a Rishut Rabim doraita on Shabbat, you're going to be deemed to be carrying the tzitzit because you're not yotze the mitzvah of tzitzit mi doraita. And therefore, the Briskers were either makpid not to wear tzitzit on Shabbat, which is pretty amazing, or they would only wear tzitzit that were woolen, and like chazonish size tzitzit. If you didn't have that, then they wouldn't wear them. Because unless you yotze the mitzvah doraita, it's considered to be carrying. So they have this chumrah that a lot of them would not wear tzitzit on Shabbat. So now we have another case. Amar Rav Shisha Brei D'Ravidi. Haiman de batzrei l'glime. Lo avid v'lo klum. Someone who, according to Rashi over here, cuts the corner. Literally, it's cutting corners. Because he doesn't want to be chayav and tzitzit. But it doesn't succeed because shavya talit balat chamesh. By cutting the corner, you can cut the corner in two ways. If you have a corner of a beged, you can slice it along the diagonal. If you do that, you end up with, instead of having a right angle there, you have a 45 degree angle, and you actually create two corners instead of having one corner. The other way to cut it is if you cut it straight up the corner. meaning that you cut from the corner inward, and then you create a cut, you also create like two triangles that are there on the side now that are flapping, but there are also two more corners. So by cutting it, you're not doing anything in order to be puter yourself from the mitzvah of tzitzit, because all you're doing is increasing the number of corners rather than eliminating the corner. Right, so that we'll see later on in the next perek, that if you round the corner out, that will solve your problem, and you will not be chayav in tzitzit if you round the corner instead of cutting the corner. Over here, he's cutting the corner, and therefore he's creating edges or corners or additional corners, and you just switch it from a four-corner baget to a five-corner baget, and we just saw before that a five-corner baget is chayav in tzitzit. All right, Amar Rav Misharsha, I mad tzairei liglime, someone who, and again here, it's not clear what he did here, tied his baget, lo avad velo klum, he didn't do anything, my taima command is sharia dami. It's the equivalent of being released. Since in the end, you didn't cut off, which we're going to see in a second, the excess material, just by tying it, it's not good enough. What Rashi says you did over here was, you folded it in half. You folded the begat in half, and then you knotted it that way, so it stays in place. It was too big, the begat. So you folded it in half, and then you tied it or knotted it in that way. That's not good enough, because you're going to end up putting the tzitzit in the area where the fold is now. And then, eventually, the knots or stuff are going to be taken apart, and the tzitzit are going to be in the middle of the begat instead of the corners of the begat. That's what Rashi says. And he's going to continue to explain the Gemara in that way. It's not Nami. We have a similar Mishnah. Kol ha-chamotot ha-tzrorot. Any flasks that are knotted to horot. They are tohor because when you knot a flask, that's not a permanent state. It will become unwound. So there's no beta kibul. There's no receptacle there to make it tameh. Chutz me'shel aravim. Except of the Arab flasks, that's the way they tie their flasks. They don't stitch their flasks. They only tie them in a knot, and that's the way they leave them permanently. Amrav Dimi min Arda, haman dechayte leglime, someone who stitches his baget, lo avad velo klum, he did nothing. Because mi'ita, delo mi'bayile, if you really didn't want that excess material, lifsok velishte, cut it off. So if you have a baget, it's too big on you. Cut it down so it's the right size. If you don't cut it down and instead you fold it over and stitch it like that, then it shows that you still want that excess. And eventually that stitching is going to come undone. And it's going to go back to being the original size. That's Rashi's reading. Tosfot already criticizes Rashi for that. And Rashi himself at the end of the perek says that this explanation doesn't make sense. But there's a braita on Mem Aleph that says that if you fold it over and stitch it, that is permanent. And you put the tzitzit in the new corners, not where the original corners were. So that goes against the Gemara later on. So for that reason, they believe that the explanation here is different, and Rashi brings that interpretation in Tosafot as well, which is that all this is not speaking about the entire baget, but the corners. If you knot the corners to eliminate the corners, that's not good enough, because it'll eventually come undone, and the corners will be there again. If you stitch up the corners, you fold them up and stitch up the corners in order to get rid of the corners, that's also not good enough, because the corners will eventually undo or unwind themselves. If you really wanted to get rid of them, you would have cut them off. The fact that you stitch the corners up just means they're going to eventually come undone and you have the corners there. You stitch the whole baget in a double way, that already is sufficient and that makes it that the baget has new corners and not the original corners of the baget. So that's how Rashi and the Tosafot in the end explain this Gemara. Rabbi Shmuel Omer Arbatan Arba Mitzvot. Rabbi Shmuel says that the four corners are four separate mitzvot. Amar Yehuda Amar Shmuel Locha K'Rabbi Shmuel. The Locha is like Rabbi Shmuel. V'lei Tilchotok Avatei. And the Loch is not like Shmuel, who says the Loch is like Rabbi Yishmael. Or in essence, the Loch is like the Chachamim. Shita Mikubetzet over here, is an Ode Hey, it says, V'lei Tilchotok Rabbi Yishmael, V'nafkamina, the Kohani Nafkuta Damranel. That is a Nafkamina, and the additional Nafkamina is a V'im Nifsak V'Shabbat, Achat Min Tzitzit. If one of the Tzitzit rips on Shabbat, Avgav B'chol Asur L'Lobsho, even though on the weekday you can't wear it, the Shabbat Mutar L'Lobsho, you can wear it on Shabbat. Sharei kavoda brioto, yot mutaf betalito b'chol, dafka, amar rachman and gedilem taselecha, because on a whole day, you have the ability to fix the problem. You can put on gedilem taselecha, alarba kamfot kusutcha, bizmanshu barasiya. At the time when you are a barasiya, there's an obligation to put tzitzit on. When you're not a barasiya, there's no obligation to put tzitzit on. Ava b'shabbat, jenu barasiya, enu muzar. You're not warned. There's no isser of doing this. Don't tell me that there's a restriction against wearing a four-corner bag without tzitzit, because there's no negative commandment. It's a positive commandment. Positive commandment is put tzitzit on a four-cornered beggar. There's no commandment. Don't wear a four-cornered bag without tzitzit. That's what's called an isser asay. the derivative from the assay is the fact that you can't do that. It brings proof to the fact that tzitzit are considered to be a mitzvah assay and not a mitzvah lota assay. If that's the case, when you can accomplish the mitzvah assay, there's an obligation to do the mitzvah assay. When you can't accomplish the mitzvah assay, there's no obligation to do the mitzvah assay. That means that gzilim, tying the knot, putting on tzitzit, is only something that is plausible on a weekday, because there you can tie the knots, put the tzitzit on. Therefore, if you go out, you have to wear a beged with the four tzitzit on. If it's missing tzitzit, you can't wear it. You need, there's your mevatel nasei if you do it. On Shabbat, on the other hand, he says, you're not mevatel nasei when you go out with a beged that's missing tzitzit. And that's because on Shabbat, there is no ability to put on tzitzit. And if the whole assay is to put on tzitzit and you can't do it on Shabbat, then by definition, you're not violating the assay on Shabbat. Amazing shita mikub, that's it. First of all, it seems to go against the Gemara here explicitly, which says that it's called carrying on Shabbat. And number two is, she says that if you, in Shabbat, since there's no ability to do asiyah, there's no restriction against going out with the beged sheino mitzu yetzeh. It's amazing shita mikubetzet. Ravina v'ka'aza abatri demar v'ravashi. Ravina was walking behind my ravashi, b'shabto derigla. It was in the Shabbat of the regel, which is, again, the case where he was giving a big shir to the public, and he's walking home from the shir. Ifsik karna dechute. Below Amar Lei, below Mide. He lost one of his tzitzit. On the way back, one of his tzitzit got caught or got torn off. So instead of having four tzitziot, he now only has three tzitziot on his beged. But Ravina doesn't say anything to Marbar Avashi. Kadmata Lebeite, when he reaches the house, once he's home, Amar Lei, Mehatam Ifsak. He said, back there it ripped off, but I'm only telling you about it now. Amar Lei, Iyamartli Mehatam Shadite. Had you told me back there, I would have thrown off my cloak. I wouldn't have worn it. I'm wearing a four-cornered beggar without tzitzit. I would have taken it off immediately. Vamamar, don't we have a memra from the Gemara in Brachot? We saw it in Shabbat, Eruvin, Megillah, that Godol Kovod Abriot shall dechet lotasesh in the Torah. That when it comes to Kovod Abriot, we allow you to violate negative precepts in the Torah. So here we've been Kovod Abriot. Here, he's walking along, he's going to throw his cloak or his shirt off in the middle of the street because he doesn't have tzitzit on it. Can't do anything. Can't fix the tzitzit. It's Shabbat. He can't carry it. So he can't take it off. He's got to take it off. He's going to walk around without a shirt. Walk around without a cloak. Whatever it is, it was unbecoming. So why isn't that override over here? So Targuma Rav Bar Shava Kameh de Rav Kahana. They explained that that memra is Belav de Lotasur. It's not an any lav. It's not with an Isur Doraita. By Isur Doraita, Kavod Abriot does not override. By Isurate de Rabbanon, Kavod Abriot does override. That's below Tasur. Below Tasur is an Isur Shibet Torah, not to listen to the Chachamim. So when it's an Isur Dirabonon, so Kon Tiltol, if it's an Isur Dirabonon, like when you're dealing with Mukso, or you're dealing with carrying in areas that are only Isur Dirabonon, over there we say Godol Kavod Abriot, it overrides. But in Rashut Rabim, Doraita, that would not override. So for instance, Rashi gives an example where you need stones. They used to use stones for their toilet paper. So stones are Mukso. So there, we're going to override the din of muksa, midrabanan, to allow someone to have toilet paper, because that's godol kovod abriot. Carry of a makum doraita, that we're not going to allow, and that's why he said to him, I would have taken my cloak off on the spot and got rid of it. Some say the story went like this. Mahatam amarle. He says, you lost your tzitzit back there. I didn't tell you, but you lost your tzitzit back there. Ramle, my datech. What are you thinking? The mishte, that I would have thrown it off, I would have taken it off, you didn't want to tell me, because it would have been. Vamamar, godol kovod abriot. Shadochet lo tasesh b'torah. It says, Targuma Rav Bar Shava Kameh de Rav Kahana b'lav de lo tasor. Wait a minute, didn't we already explain that was limited or qualified? It's not any lav d'oraita that you can violate. It's only an isur d'rabanan. Hachanami karmeli d'rabanani. Over there, it was only a location that it's an isur to carry in me d'rabanan. So there, it was only an isur d'rabanan. And he says, even if you had told me back then, I wouldn't have thrown my cloak off because it's only an isur d'rabanan. You should have told me back then. And I would have just kept going until I got to the house. But now that I'm in the house, I'll take it off because obviously you can't wear a beged sheino mitzu yetzeh. So I think it's interesting from two perspectives. One perspective is that sometimes it's good not to tell people information. And that sometimes it's better to withhold the information. Even though now wearing the beged is problematic because it's missing tzitzit, but the alternative, which is informing of this, and he's going to have to take his beged off in the middle of the street, better not to tell him and allow him to go home b'shogeg and then take it off there for kavod abriot. That you see that Ravina withheld that information from him because he wanted to protect him from that problem. Now, obviously, in the second story, that's not that way, because then the Rabbani wouldn't have thrown it off, and he was mistaken in doing that. But still, the whole concept that he withheld information, sometimes it's not worth telling someone the information, is an important lesson for us in general. You don't always have to tell people what they're doing wrong. Because sometimes that information is not useful at that time, and it's not going to help them at that time. You have to pick the right moment to tell them the information where it's going to be useful, and they can do something about it where it's not going to be problematic. That's why you waited to get home. Okay, with that we complete the third perek, Hadron Halach, HaKometz, and we're going to continue in the fourth perek now with issues of Tehillah and Tzitzit.